Hello and welcome to the Cali Outdoorsman podcast. This is Tyler Morris, your host. And today we have a guest, Brennan. And I met Brennan through Instagram. And we've been fishing together. And we've talked about going hunting and stuff. And hopefully in the future we will. So, Brennan, you want to say hi?
Hey, guys. How's it going?
So, so we'll just kind of jump into it. We actually recorded a podcast first and it got deleted. So I'm going to, so we're kind of doing this for a second time around, and, it's kind of because I'm new at the whole podcast thing. But we'll go ahead and kind of go over the same things that we had talked about, cause only me and you know about it.
It's a practice run.
Yeah, exactly. A practice run. So, all the people that I'm interviewing, I'm trying to just kind of get a basic on, what started with the outdoors for you, for everyone I'm going to be interviewing. So like what would you say got you started? Like, you know, was it hunting or fishing? And what drove you to, start doing outdoor activities or whatever?
Yeah, so I've been around the outdoors, hunting and fishing and going camping and stuff my whole life. My grandpa and my uncle fished a lot, and so that's how it started for me. It started, my mom would just take me when I was a baby, and I'd go out either to the pier or to the lakes or whatever when my grandpa was fishing, and I'd just be around while he was doing that. But when I was 4 or 5, I started fishing. And actually had some birthday parties, like trout deal and stuff, when it still existed. And just had a super fun time. And so that's how it started. When I was 5, my uncle started introducing me to hunting. And so I did learn how to be safe with a gun and stuff for what seemed like a long time. And then I finally, when I was 5, when rabbit season started, I finally got to go hunting, and so I got my first rabbit when I was 5 years old, and, so safe to say I've been hunting and fishing for most of my life.
That's awesome. So, like, for, a lot of people, because, like, so for me, for example, like, it's cool because you got introduced at a very young age, and I think a lot of people, I mean, even a lot of my followers I already know, are still like getting into hunting or fishing. And as of myself too, like, I mean, this, I've only been big game hunting for, 4 years now, 4 or 5 years now. So like, there's still a lot, I still have a lot to learn, and, it's a lot of it's new to me. It wasn't something that like I had family members to show me or to like to pass down to me. So it's cool that like, you know, that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to try to do this podcast, is just to hear from people with different perspectives, I guess. Because like you were saying that you went to Troutdale, and I don't know, for people that have never heard of what Troutdale was, it was like a private pond, or you describe it a little bit better, because I never went. I actually just, I drove by it and it was already closed down when I went and saw it. But
right. Well, now it's just like a couple of old abandoned swimming pools, which is more or less what it was. It was a couple of concrete, like mini ponds that they had over, off of Canaan Road in Malibu. And you can drive down there and pull in, and, you go out and you fish, and they would give you, they give you everything you need. Even if you didn't have any, stuff to fish with, they'd give you a fishing pole and bait and all the tackle and stuff. And you go and you fish for trout, and they're stocked trout, but some of them got pretty big. A couple of them could get up to a few pounds. And so, it was fun. You can go and you catch fish, and they're always hungry because they kept them hungry. So everybody could catch lots of fish.
Yeah.
And then you basically just pay for what you caught. I don't remember if it was by weight or by inches, but you basically just pay for whatever you caught. And, so it was a fun way growing up, cause you're almost guaranteed to catch a fish. And yeah. So that was super fun for like kids, you know, cause kids just want to go out and catch a fish. They don't care if it's a big fish or small fish. They just want to go out and not have to sit there for 3 hours in the cold and maybe catch a fish. They just want to go and catch a fish.
It's like that saying, the tug is the drug, you know? It's like, if you're not getting bit, it doesn't matter if it's a minnow out there biting your line, but if you feel something, it moves through your veins versus if you're sitting there and it's nothing's biting, you could have 100 fish around your line, but if they're not biting, nobody cares, you know?
Totally. Yeah, so Troutdale was super cool for that. I had some birthday parties, and obviously not everyone who went to them got in like I did, but yeah. We still had a great time and caught fish, and I have a bunch of pictures of all of my relatives catching fish, even my other grandpa who didn't fish very much, and some cousins of mine and stuff. Everybody caught fish.
That's awesome.
So it was super cool. I had my fourth and my fifth birthday parties there because I just loved it so much.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I tell my wife and stuff that like I wish that we had more places like that around here now, because now that I have kids, you know, I kind of came from a different background when it comes to fishing, and the people that took me fishing were a little bit more hardcore, and so like it took me a while to actually latch on to fishing because it was like too hardcore almost, you know. And I think you told me, we'll go over it a little bit later, about how your more of your native fish experience was kind of like that, you know what I mean? It's like a it's a hardcore feeling, and so like for my girls, you know, they're only, I have three daughters, two of them, my twins are 3 years old and one's five, and to try to entertain them while fishing is quite a handful. But like if they were in a safe environment with sidewalks around a pond and the fish were biting, I mean, it would just, I feel like it would make for a lot more of a fun time for them, you know?
Yeah, it's really good to spark their interest and get them involved and get them introduced to fishing and how much fun it can be. Like you said, the tug is the drug, so it's a good one to get them hooked on, you know?
Yeah.
I always said that I don't have any time or money for drugs because I'm too busy hunting and fishing. So.
Right. Yeah. So you started fishing more like Troutdale and stuff, and then, so that was probably like one of your first passions then was fishing before hunting, correct?
We started pretty close to each other, but I'd still say that fishing was first.
Yeah.
And I definitely did it a lot more often, because I could go with my grandpa, and he was already retired pretty much by the time I was old enough to start going fishing, so. I'd go out for the weekends, and he lived in Port Hueneme, and so I'd go fishing on the pier with him.
Yeah.
And that was fun. I'd just go catch bait fish for him, and then he'd use the bait fish, try to catch big fish and stuff, which was cool, but for me, it was just fun to go catch mackerel and sardines. And,
oh, yeah. Those things,
little fish, because then
they got a lot of tug.
Catching stuff. Yeah.
They have a lot of tug for their size. You know, I think everybody gets excited whenever they catch a mackerel, even people that have been fishing a long time, until they see it, then they're like, dang it, it's a mackerel, you know. But yeah. But that initial bite, you're like, oh man, this thing is fighting like crazy. But
so that was a lot of fun, because like you said, it's another high action kind of thing when the mackerel are running. And so that was what I did as a kid. Man, it was so much fun. You know, you wake up early and you get excited. We go out there right at daybreak. And, it was a good time. So that's how I started.
And then, so you, I know we kind of already talked about this before. So then you started getting into, like your freshwater fishing. You started doing more, like you were going on trips to the Sierras, right?
Yeah, my entire family started going up. Well, my uncle and my grandparents and stuff have been going up since the 80s. But my whole family started going up about the time I was 5 or 6 years old. So I'd been fishing for a year or two actively. And so we started going up to the Sierras to the June Lake Loop or the Mammoth. And so that was fun because then I got to go up and start doing freshwater fishing and trout fishing, and that was just a blast. It wasn't as high, you know, obviously not as high paced as mackerel fishing or fishing in Troutdale, but it was just being out in nature and being exposed to, like, you know, the actual great outdoors, not just like a stocked pool.
Yeah.
So that was cool. And, you know, you get to go see bald eagles and deer and
Yeah, there's a lot more.
All sorts of cool stuff.
I feel like there's a reason why a lot of people go hiking and stuff up there, and not just fishing. You have so much nature up there that's just awesome to see.
It's just beautiful.
I was gonna say, I personally love running water too. So like whenever I get near creeks or rivers, they get me all excited because there's just so much. I feel like there's just so much life whenever you're fishing around a creek or a river, you know. So it's definitely a lot different than fishing a stocked pond.
Yeah, I mean, when I still started the same way. I'd fish off the bank with a little ball of power bait or a worm or something, and you just throw it out there with a bobber.
Yeah,
because that's easy for kids to do. You can put it down, the kids can go run around and play with sticks or whatever, and then if you get a bite, you can see it.
Yeah.
So it started that way. But yeah, we did that for a long time. We did that for almost 10 years.
Oh, wow.
My whole family going. And so then that was fun because I could do it with my uncle and my grandpa. And my mom was super cool, so she'd like let me get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go with all the guys and go fishing and stuff.
Yeah.
Even when I was super little.
That's right.
And they bought me my own fishing vest that matched all the old guys, so I felt like I was one of the old guys. And
there you go.
So it was just stuff like that. It was just amazing, and it was great to get me hooked.
Yeah.
And I still have a ton of pictures of me sitting on the dock or sitting in my uncle's old 14-foot Gregor boat or whatever. Just, like, the look on my face just says it all.
Yeah.
About how I was just so hooked.
That's awesome, man.
I was definitely more hooked than the fish were.
So. Yeah. So I think last time you were saying that you had you started taking it more seriously as you got older and you guys were targeting more like brown trout, right?
Yeah. So when I turned 12 years old, 12 is like the big magic age in California for hunting, because you can hunt big game when you turn 12.
Yeah.
But it was about the same time that my uncle found that I was old enough to start going up with just the guys. It's just my uncle and his friend for his whole life that he had been going fishing with. And they'd been fishing together up in the Sierras for over 30 years.
Oh, wow.
fishing for big brown trout. And yes. So, I mean, that was just great for me because I was going up with guys who had already figured it out and they had 30 years of experience, you know, so they could teach me the ropes. But and that's definitely what we're talking about hardcore fishing. You know, we go out and you're tent camping, and opening weekend is in the end of April, so there's still snowstorms and rain.
Yeah.
And just super cold. I mean, I remember going out and just being freezing, and I was like, I just wish I was in the hotel room sleeping.
Yeah.
Getting up at 4 in the morning so that we could be at the river before it got light, so we could be where we wanted, hike out to where we wanted to be at daybreak. So, you know, you get up at 4 in the morning and it's like 11 degrees out.
Yeah.
The wind's blowing and it's snowing and your feet are already freezing before you can get out of the truck.
Yeah, I know.
It's just,
I'm a California fisherman sometimes. I don't like wearing gloves when it comes to fishing. And it's hard when you get into that cold of weather to not have gloves on.
Yeah.
Like, and near impossible.
And it's those, like, sucky moments when in the moment you're like, I don't want to be here at all, that are just so fun when you think back on it. You're like, it sucks so bad, but it was so much fun.
Yeah.
But I went fishing with them and learned how to fish rivers and learned how to fish big water and fish with lures and fish for big fish and present lures a certain way and stuff. And I didn't catch my first big brown trout for 4 years. For four wow. years, I went up 2 or 3 weekends a year. We'd fish for 2, 3, 4 days. I mean, we'd fish all day. Get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, fish, go back for lunch for like maybe an hour and go back out or hit a new spot and just fish all day. Go back at dark, make dinner, and go to bed.
Yeah.
And 4 years of just opening weekend, Memorial Day weekend, maybe in June once school got out. So 3 or 4 weekends a year.
Wow.
And just nothing. I catched a couple stalkers because eventually my uncle would realize that I was getting frustrated. So
take you to some easy spots.
He'd go find some stream where he knew that there was some smaller fish that I could catch just so that I wouldn't hate fishing and fall together.
Well, every now and then you gotta keep the interest going, man.
Yeah, he'd definitely throw me a bone, you know.
Yeah.
Like, all right, we've been out here for like 7 hours and It's snowy and cold, and he just wants to catch a fish. So yeah. Eventually he would take us. But then watching my uncle catch, you know, 18 or 20-inch browns, and my uncle's friend Paul, who recently passed away, him catching fish too, it's just like, I want that.
Yeah.
That was like, that's like the four-pointer buck that you see on all the old-timers' walls.
Yeah.
And you just, like, when I was a little kid, I can remember I walked into my uncle's living room, and he has just these giant local bucks everywhere, all of them are like 18 to 20 inches. He's got up on the wall, tons of four-pointers and all this. And of course, he's got like 30-inch bucks from out of state, from Wyoming and Utah. And he's got elk and stuff. And he also has a 9-pound, 2-ounce brown mounted in his living room.
Where did you get that from? Like,
he got it up in the Sierras out of a river called Robinson Creek. And that was back in the 80s.
Oh, wow.
And there's a spillway that comes out of these lakes called the Twin Lakes.
Yeah.
And the Twin Lakes are known. They used to have the world record brown trout, and they catch consistently very big fish out of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so sometimes the fish go over the spillway and they get stuck in the river. And my uncle just happened to find one of those fish one day and, nailed a 9-pound brown. And so I'd go up there and I'd stare at all those, you know, giant trophies. And like, someday. I haven't got a 9-pound brown yet.
Yeah, what's your personal best so far?
My personal best is probably, I think he's about 4.5 pounds and 22 inches long.
Oh, that's a pretty good trout, man.
So it's nothing to sneeze at. It's a very nice fish. And I'm like super stoked to have caught him. I caught him 2 years ago now.
Nice.
But I was like so stoked. I mean, I was like shaking. It was like I had buck fevers. so bad. I was so jacked up.
I bet. Do you So you guys mainly target browns. Do you guys go after, like, have you ever fished for golden trout at all?
No, you know what? I never have. Just because I have nothing against golden trout.
But no, they don't get lazy. Big.
Yeah, they get lazy.
Yeah.
And I'm lazy. And the brown, the golden trout are like, you know, 10 or 12 inch natural fish.
Yep.
And so when you go for golden trout, you're not going for a big fish. You're just going for the experience of catching the golden trout, hiking in the backcountry, hitting the high lakes. And there's nothing against that, though. No one in my family does it.
Yeah.
And I'm lazy. And if I'm going to drive 7 hours, I like to catch some big fish. You know?
Yeah.
I'm just really hooked on river fishing and brown fishing.
Yeah, I got super lucky. Well, it was funny because it wasn't even like a, you know, I don't do a lot of, I need to go over to the Sierras because I haven't really fished on the eastern side of the Sierras. I fish on the lower end over by Kern River because my dad actually has a cabin up by Lake Isabella. And a few years back, me and my wife, it was our first wedding anniversary. We went up there and stayed at his cabin. And then we went fishing up the Kern River, but we went up pretty far. And there was a little creek that spilled into the river. And the river was just, it was flowing pretty good. I'm trying to remember, because it was for our anniversary, so it was in May. So it was like, you know, it was still a lot of snow melt.
High water.
Yeah, so like the lower parts of the Kern were just muddy as could be, and the upper parts were just flowing like crazy.
Yeah.
And so we went up, I just kept going up higher. We just kind of went for a drive for the day, but I kept stopping and looking for places to fish. And we found this one little creek, and I was like, oh, cool, there's a couple little pockets in here. We'll just go catch some little fish for fun, you know? And so we stopped in there with an ultralight rod and caught a couple of these little fish, and I thought they were like little spawning trout, like native trout, because like they just kind of looked like a rainbow trout. But I took a bunch of pictures. I'm pretty good about taking pictures of all the fish I catch, and so I caught them, and then I showed them to my dad, and like nobody ever really said anything to me. And then like a year or two later, we went up to the hatchery there in Kernville, right above Lake Isabella. And the hatchery there has got a whole, like, they have a museum in there, and it's pretty cool. And they have a golden trout poster in there from, like, of all the different golden trout. I didn't realize there were so many different strands of golden trout in California.
Right.
And I looked at it, and there it was. There's two different kinds of Kern River golden trout. two different colors. And so I was looking at it and I go, no way. And I took a picture of it and I was like, I'm going to compare that later. And I did, I pulled them up and sure enough, the ones that we were catching, they were little golden trout. And I thought they were just like, native. I thought they were native rainbows. So we were just catching them and releasing them. But I, he'd caught a couple of them. And then it was funny because like I said, like it was a couple years later, we went back up there and I saw that and was like, I've caught those before. Like, I didn't know that's what the golden trout looked like. Wow, because awesome. You think of a golden trout as like a, like a golden trout. You think it's going to be like a golden color or something or have some sort of golden stuff. But this one is, it looked like a,
It looked like a fry rainbow,
but it had weird spots on it. And that's what caught my eye was, I thought it almost looked like a brook trout. Like, have you ever caught brook trout?
I've caught one.
They have like those crazy pink spots.
It was like 6 inches long.
Well, yeah, a lot of them are pretty small, but they have like these distinctive spots, and browns kind of have them, but browns are normally like a dark spot. They look like freckles.
Yeah.
And these the brook trout are normally pink, or they're like bright color, and this thing had kind of odd color one. It didn't look like a normal rainbow fry, but then at the same time I was like, I don't know what else it would be, because it had like the bars like a rainbow trout. But anyways, it was funny. But yeah, because they have, like, where you guys go, they probably have a lot of cutthroat too, right? Because there's browns, those more in the lakes.
Not a lot. There's definitely more browns, but I've caught cutthroat before up there. So,
and then the most of them are probably rainbows, right?
Yeah, they're rainbows. They're stocked, and there's some natural rainbows, but most of them are stocked or naturalized, like holdover ones.
Holdover
rainbow trout.
Have you caught any of those? A buddy of mine goes up there, and they caught a bunch of these fish, and they were like a perch.
Sacramento perch.
So there's
catch them, Lake Crowley.
Yeah,
is where most people go to catch lots of Sacramento perch.
Yeah, they were fishing, I think, like the inlet or something, and they were catching these things. And the picture, what was funny is he sent me a couple pictures of them, and they were like almost like a half breed, because they weren't identical to like anything that we would pull up that said a Sacramento perch. It was like a different strand of them, because they don't look like a normal Sacramento perch. And I had a few other people that I was reading up on a forum saying that it's like its own Eastern Sierra's like strand, but they were saying that they're kind of like an invasive species, like they've showed up later. But I was just curious if you'd caught any of those things before.
I haven't. I've only fished that I know of one lake. I've never fished Crowley, because that's where the crowds go on opening weekend. Crowley Lake is like a city on the water.
Yeah.
Something like 3,000 fishermen in boats and 6,000 on the shore of Lake Crowley on opening weekend.
Oh, wow.
Seriously, you could probably walk across Crowley Lake from boat to boat and not touch water on opening weekend.
Yeah.
And I don't like crowds, so we get far away from crowds. But that's where most people that I've talked to catch Sacramento perch. But Bridgeport Reservoir, which is about an hour and a half north of Crowley, has Sacramento perch, and that's what the big browns eat.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so if browns get big enough, they'll eat lots of Sacramento perch, because they breed like bluegill. They actually related to bluegill and crappie and stuff.
Yeah, that's what we thought at first. We thought it was like a half-breed crappie, like some sort of odd breed of crappie.
Like. Yeah, like a crappie mixed with a smallmouth bass.
They do. That's, yeah, or like almost like the first time I saw it, I was thinking that it could have been like a... or almost like a walleye, because they have bigger eyes. They look like a walleye with a big, like a elongated belly. So it's like more like a crappie or something. It was a funky looking fish. But he showed me pictures of it, because the ones he showed me pictures of were pretty decent. Like they were like a crappie, were big enough to where you definitely could eat them. Like if you got a couple of them, they looked like big panfish, but they were kind of tripping out, because they were like, what are these things,
And I've heard that Sacramento perch are some of the best-eating fish that there are.
Really?
My uncle caught one in a really bad storm out of Bridgeport Reservoir, and they cooked it and said it was amazing.
Really?
And I've seen other people catch Sacramento Bridgeport Reservoir. I've just never been that lucky. Yeah. I guess I'm just a better trout fisherman.
You're probably not targeting them really either, though.
No, I'm fishing lures that are probably too big.
Yeah.
But you know, whatever. That's the price you pay.
Going for the big boys.
Trying to be greedy and catching big browns, even if I don't know the cool fish.
Yeah. So,
keep like 50 of the Sacramento perch too, I think. So, I mean, you can just fill up your boat with them if you wanted to have a big fish fry.
Yeah, that'd be kind of fun. I wonder, I should look into it more, because I bet you you probably can fish for them just like you would crappie, like with little crappie jigs or something, you know. You just got to find a school of them and sit there and pull them out of the school. So far we've talked about, like, how you got started with fishing, and then, you know, your freshwater. Now, you said that you did some saltwater fishing with your grandpa when you were younger, but other than that, do you do a lot more saltwater fishing, or now that you're older or anything, or?
I do a little bit more. I live in Moore Park, and so it's farther away to go saltwater fishing, or any fishing, really. I mean, I have to drive almost an hour to do any fishing at all, other than, like, those little stocker ponds and seamy, but those are kind of boring for me nowadays, so.
Yeah.
So I don't do as much fishing anymore. I still try to get out whenever I can, but I grew up surf fishing, too. We'd go camping in Carpinteria. My family would, and so I do lots of surf fishing and catch perch and stuff. I caught a halibut one time from the surf, and it was 18 inches, so I had to go back.
Oh, yeah. That's a bummer.
But, yeah, I grew up doing that, and I've gone on charter boats before, but I get seasick, so.
Yeah, they can, that kills the fun out of it real fast if you're sick.
I mean, I would consider myself a pretty hardcore fisherman, so I fish whether I'm sick or not. And I used the ear patch the last time I went a few years ago, and that worked, and I didn't get sick. So I really don't have an excuse for not going anymore. Yeah.
We'll have to get you out on one of my charters or something. It'd be fun.
Definitely. I'm super interested in that. So.
Yeah. And then we've gone surf fishing, and you got a Corbina. Have you been out? Yeah, did you just get the one, right?
So far. But I have to give a huge thank you to that, man. I didn't think it was ever going to happen. My mom was making fun of me because... My uncle always talked about catching Corbina, and my mom always called him a unicorn. She's like, "Yeah, you're gonna catch Bigfoot, or you're gonna catch a unicorn, or something." You know, she's like, "They don't exist; they're a myth."
Well, you know, what's one of the funniest parts about that whole thing was, you know, I'd only caught one when we went out fishing. I'd only caught one Corbina, or maybe two, but like I mean, I'm not like a professional Corbina target fisherman or something, you know. Like, I just fish the surf, and I've seen what other people do, but I feel like a lot of surf fishing is just putting in the time and, you know, like being on the water, you know. Like, you can tell 100 people the exact setup that you use to catch a Corbina, and, you know, you're probably only going to get like 2 or 3 people that are actually going to stick to it and catch stuff, you know what I mean? Like, because it's just a matter of, like, putting your time on the water, I feel like. And when we went out, I feel like that was, like, the perfect example. It was, like, you know, we went out, and then, like, you know, we caught a couple little things. I think we caught some surf perch. And I think that trip that we went out,
surf perch.
And then did we get leopard sharks that day, or was that the time before that? Because we were catching a bunch of these little leopard sharks one of the times that I went out. They were, like, 8 or 10 inches.
I can't remember if it was that time or not.
Yeah, I think it might have been the one before.
I do know that one time I went with you, you didn't catch a baby leopard shark, so
yeah.
I can't remember which one it was.
But we, you know, I didn't catch Corbina with you, but then I left early, and then you ended up catching one right after. And it's like, that's what I mean. It's like a prime example of, like, if you stick to it and you put the time in, you know, like, because you could have just left when I left and been like, you know what? You know, we're not going to catch it. You know, I'm not going to catch anything if I stay any longer, you know. But you stay, like, how much longer did it take until you hooked into that guy?
Like 15 or 20 minutes.
Right?
It was almost right after you left.
Yeah, it was like I was taking the bad luck or something, you know. But, and that was a good one, too. How big was that one? Do you remember?
He was 20 inches. So 20. He wasn't, like, a huge one, but he was definitely a nice fish. And the second I hooked into it, I can see why everybody wanted Corbina, man. It felt like a brown trout. It was like I was brown trout fishing.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, this is great. Because perch, you know, they like tap, 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 and then you hook them, and they fight like a tiny bit, and they turn sideways, and you pull them in.
Yeah.
But like a Corbina, he was pulling drag and bending my rod over, and I thought for a while I was going to have to run into the surf because I was fishing ultralight.
That's what I like to do, you know? Like, I feel like the ultralight's a blast. Ultralight.
Yeah.
It takes, the only thing is you got to be careful. I feel like, you know, like a lot of these guys that go out there and they fish those lucky crafts or something like that, those things will catch a lot bigger of fish than
you want. I was going to catch shovel nose over a lucky craft.
Well, did you see me catch it was like maybe a week or two after you caught yours, I caught a big old shovel nose on 4-pound test on my ultralight. Did you see the picture of that?
I saw a picture of your shovel nose. Why didn't you know it was on 4-pound test?
Dude, it was that same little trout rod that I have. It's a little Eagle Claw collapsible rod that I have with 4-pound tests. Dang. And I caught it on the exact same setup that, you know, it was just the slider with the freaking little tiny hook and a little small sand crab out there. And I hooked into it. And to be honest with you, I thought it was a halibut because I knew it shuffled itself into the sand. Like, I felt it, and he was ripping line, and then all of a sudden, he shuffled himself in the sand, and it was weird, because you could feel it, and then, like, I looked down the waves, and you could see where he shuffled a big old area in the sand, because, you know, like, when I took you out there, like, I was kind of showing you how it's, like, they're, like, literally in ankle-deep water, you know, everything, like, the majority of it.
I mean, they're like,
yeah,
you could, like,
step on one.
Yeah, you could literally step on one.
Yeah, and so, like, I wasn't fishing.
Like, a wave did come in while we were standing there. We're talking like, oh, I don't see any Corbina swirls. And I took a step forward, and one swirled like a foot and a half in front of me.
Yeah. So they were like super shallow, so I wasn't fishing super deep. So when this thing took off, it went out a little bit farther, but like I could see, you know, the wave sets coming in, and it was probably only like 2, maybe 3 feet deep where he had ran to. And then he was like trying to shuffle himself in the sand. And I was like, shoot, I thought it was a big halibut. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I was all freaking out. And I, you know, my buddy comes running over, and I was like, dude, it's something big. And he actually, I think he filmed me. I can't remember. I should look at my phone. I think he filmed me. And I fought it for like 5 minutes, dude. It was just, it just kept running, taking line, and then it would shuffle itself in the sand, and then I'd sit there and try to pull it from different directions, and then finally it would, you know, pick its head up. It'd pick its head up, and then it'd start coming in, like, kind of slowly, and it'd get real shallow. Then as soon as he'd see me, it'd take off again, and I was like, dang it, man. And so finally I got it. What I did was I, like, pulled him, and I was walking up the beach with him. Yeah. I was, like, walking up, and then I had my buddy run up, and that was, like, the scariest part was because he was running up to go get it. I couldn't get close to it because if he saw me, then he would take off running. Yeah, he had to kind of have, like, a sneak attack on this thing, and so he waited until it got really shallow, and then he ran in when a wave was going out. And was able to grab it by the tail, but I think the thing was, it was probably had to be 3 feet. Yeah, it had to be like 3 feet or something. It was a big old shovel nose. For like, if I just caught it on regular line, I would have been pretty stoked. But because I caught it on 4-pound, I was amped, man. It was cool. So
yeah, that's awesome. I love fishing ultralight.
Yeah, but I caught a Corbina again. Like I think the following trip after that. And they definitely fight ways. They have way more power. It's just with the other one, it was so much mass trying to bring it against the waves. It was like just a matter of working against the waves with something that was so big, you know? But the Corbina itself, like they actually, it was ripping line and it's more of a fight.
Definitely.
Like you said, it's almost like a
leopard sharks and stuff. And like you said, it's just mass and they just feel heavy and you got to fight the waves.
Yeah.
But that Corbina, man, it was just cutting through the wave. It was just ripping line off. So.
Yeah. I know, I think one of the fish that I've seen that reminds me of it a lot, that I really want to try fishing for is redfish, like over in Texas and Florida and stuff. Yeah. Have you ever seen those things? Totally. They look a lot like them. And they seem to have
almost just like them.
Yeah, but they get a lot bigger. And I was like, man, a lot of the guys go fly fishing for them and stuff. And I mean, you know, it's pretty popular here too that people go fly fishing for the Corbina. But and that's a whole other game. I think, I don't know if you listened to that podcast before, but my cousin's been trying to do it, and it's just a challenge, man, to try and have the patience to fly fish in the surf. I want to learn how to fly fish, but I feel like it's going to be quite a while before I actually get out in the surf fly fishing, just because it's one of those things that I feel like is going to test your patience pretty good.
Definitely. I mean, hats off to those guys. Yeah. I met your buddy when we went out. I can't remember his name. Was that? The guy with a sweet mustache.
Oh, Devin.
Devin, that's right. And he was fly fishing, and we were fishing with sand crabs. Yep. But hats off to all those guys who fly fish and surf, because that is just, like, so trying on your patience, and you got to be in the water all the time.
Yeah. Were you, I think the day that you came down, or it might have been another one, because I fished with him twice out there that same time period, but he got a nice little leopard shark, and I think a shovel nose that same, or I don't know if it was when you were out there or not, but on the fly, he was pretty pumped on that, because they're, he was trying to go for Corbina.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I was pretty stoked, like, I get stoked whenever I see them pull anything in, because I'm like, man, this, you know, it's a lot more work, you know. A lot of the times, like, I'm going out there, I'm fine with fishing with sand crabs or those little Berkeley, the gulp worms or whatever. I mean, those work too, but at the same time, those are pretty much bait too, so you're just kind of, you're waiting, you know. You're almost guaranteed, as long as the fish are out there, that they're going to eat it. But, and then, so you've done some surf fishing, and then, what do we haven't talked about hunting much. So you did, you said that you started rabbit hunting when you were five.
Yeah, which is basically just, I mean, like, the first couple times we went out, it was dedicated. My uncle brought a 22 for me, and we just went looking for rabbits. But after that, I just tag along with my uncle, and he'd be either coyote hunting, which he does a lot, or we'd be bird hunting or whatever, and there'd be a 22 in the backseat of the truck. And if we saw a rabbit, he'd get out and he'd set up the rifle for me. I could hunt some rabbits, like, opportunistically, you know.
But,
So that's how I started hunting. And then I started, you know, tagging along while he was hunting coyotes and stuff. And I got my first coyote when I was probably nine or ten.
Really? That's awesome.
I started shooting, you know, higher caliber stuff, and so my uncle taught me how to shoot one of his old guns, a 257 Roberts, is some total wildcat cartridge, but it's super fun, and it's low kick, and it's still strong enough to take down deer around here.
Yeah.
And so that's what I started using, and my uncle always said coyotes are the best practice for hunting deer. Because who cares if you miss?
Right? Yeah.
It's still like actual hunting. You have to set up and you're setting up at weird angles. You have to be sneaky and stuff. But if you miss a coyote, it's like whatever.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Like, I mean, it's cool to talk to you because, like, you've been, even though you're younger than me, you have a lot more experience in these things just because you were introduced at a younger age and you've...
Oh, yeah, I'm just super blessed to have grown up with a family who can hunt locally, so...
Yeah, because, I mean, like, I just got my first coyote, like, not even a month ago or something like that. It was my first coyote. And what's funny, though, is, like, my grandpa, I don't know if I've really talked about it, but my grandpa lives out in Wyoming, or he has lived out there most of my childhood and stuff. And, he's super into coyote hunting. I guess that's like his, like, he's a big meat hunter. He likes to hunt for meat. So he would get a lot of does and cow, elk and stuff like that.
He still
has a lot of, like, big game animals that he's got that were really good, bucks and bulls and stuff. But you know, he always got meat every year. That was, like, his big thing, was he always wanted to have the meat in the freezer kind of thing. But he also had a lot of friends that were ranchers, and he got into, like, what they did a lot of coyote hunting was in the winter, they would go on snow machines, and they would chase coyotes.
Okay.
So you'd call them until you could see them, and then they'd get on their snow machines, and they'd have these super fast snow machines, and, you know, because out where they would go hunting for them, you know, you're talking so much snow that, like, a lot of the times the trees are covered. So, like, an area that would be covered with trees now is covered with snow and just, like, little tips of the trees. So like, yes. So heavily wooded, yeah. So a heavily wooded area is now, you know, pretty much a plain, open plains. Yeah. So all these places where there would be a lot of coyotes who would hide out, or where they have their dens at, would be more out in the open, and these guys, they'd be able to chase them down. And I was like, man, that's pretty nuts to be able to chase down coyotes. And like out there, it's kind of the same deal. It's like nobody really cares. So it's like,
right.
You know, it's like if you're chasing down deer to shoot them and hunt them, that's different. But yeah, when you're chasing down, especially on ranches and stuff, like, you know, those things are calf killers for ranchers, yeah. Out the cattle ranchers. So,
well, same around here. That's why my uncle does so much.
Yeah,
is a lot of the time, you know, if you have those connections, and my uncle has, you know, he grew up on a homestead in between Somas and Santa Paula, and I'm fifth generation Ventura County, so we know lots of people, and we know cattle ranchers and stuff, and so sometimes, if hunting's slow or whatever, they're like, hey, we got a bunch of coyotes out here, so we gotta go take care of coyotes, but...
Yeah. I think the easiest one to get into is ground squirrels. If you're ever trying to get access to hunting, if it's like, if there's one thing that anybody wants gone off their property, it's definitely ground squirrels. It doesn't matter it doesn't matter if they have a vineyard, or they got an orchard, or they got horses, or they got cattle. Nobody likes ground squirrels, man.
That's for sure. A slow day of coyote hunting turned into ground squirrel hunting pretty fast.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and that's one of the things I'd like to get a little bit more into doing that, because, like, even in my backyard, I got ground squirrels in my backyard, but those things are, they're smart little things. You think that they aren't, but, I mean, I can't walk out my back door with an air gun without them disappearing, because as soon as I walk out the back door, they know. And they might be out there all, you know, all afternoon while we're having a barbecue. But like I said, as soon as I walk out there with an air gun, they're like, boom, they're gone. There's not a single one in sight, you know? So, yeah. But, so you did coyote hunting, you did rabbit hunting, then coyote hunting. And then did you do a lot of bird hunting, or do you do a lot of bird hunting?
Never waterfowl, but I do lots of upland hunting. I love quail hunting. And I like dove hunting. I've never gone dove hunting other than, like, opportunistic dove hunting. I mean, I hunt the early season sometimes, but that's normally during the A-zone deer season. And so I don't have a lot of time to hunt doves during the early season because I'm busy looking for deer.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, if I get a chance to go during the early season, I will. And my buddies and I will go look for some doves in a couple spots where, you know, they hang out. But never, like, you know, I've never been to Yuma like you did. Or I've never been to, like, even up to some place where I just know there's a lot of doves. It's just more like, I know where a couple hang out.
Yeah.
And so you go look for them. Or if you're quail hunting and it's late season doves, like I did just last week with my buddy, you get a couple.
Yeah.
Get a couple doves here and there.
Well, so, you know, it's really hard. I've noticed, because I love dove hunting, but, like, Yuma is awesome. And I think the main thing that makes it awesome is the opportunity on private land. And I think that's what kind of sucks around here, is we don't have, I mean, not everybody has the opportunity on private land. Because, you know what I mean? Like, if we had, I mean, we live in a high agriculture area, which is typically where dove love. You know, because they're, at least, like, Eurasian dove are huge on it. Morning dove love, like, anywhere where they grow hay, which, you know, out there in Moorpark. Yeah, so, I mean, out in Moorpark and stuff where you live at, there's plenty of places where people will grow hay fields, and same with, you know, Oxnard, Ventura area. There's tons of places where people have a lot of like hay fields or grain fields. So it's not like they're not here. It's just they typically stick to those areas or the waterways around those areas. And around here, we don't have a lot of public land that's got the waterways or the ag around those, you know, around it. So it really limits it. And, like, that's one of the coolest things. If you ever want to go to Yuma, let me know, because it's one of the coolest parts about it is what Fish and Game, they kind of did a deal where they basically kind of back hunters on private land, and it basically opened up, like, they basically I was watching this thing on YouTube about it one time, and they basically made a deal with landowners to where, like, they're not liable for hunters on their property, kind of thing. during dove hunting season. So, like, not entirely, but it was, like, a thing, like, to kind of shelter them, because around here, that's one of the biggest things. Like, you don't want anybody going hunting on your property that you don't fully trust with a gun. You know what I mean? Even if you're a big pro, you know, pro hunter, you don't, it's just common sense that you don't let somebody on your property go hunting unless you are 100% positive they're really good with their gun and they know all the laws and they're, you know what I mean? And even still at that, it's like, you still probably are only going to let friends and family go, kind of thing. You know, it's not like you're not going to just let random people come out and shoot on your property. And out there, you know, you go out for dove opener, it's like, basically there's like probably 10% of the properties that you can't go on, and everything else, it's just a walk on basis. You can walk on, you can drive on their roads, and it's crazy, you know, man.
And I think in Arizona, correct me if I'm wrong, because I've never been hunting in Arizona, but I have family who live there, and I have friends who hunt there and stuff. And so basically, during the dove opener and stuff, it's like, if it's not posted as private land and you can't hunt it, that you assume that you can hunt it.
Correct. That's what they basically say. And in Yuma, I mean, I'm pretty sure it's well known now that if you do not have signs up, you're going to get trespassers, because that's like that's kind of the deal. Like, they have so many people that come in that, like, if you don't want people on your property, just make it known, because nobody goes on those properties. Because what they'll do is, most of the time, like, I mean, and this last year I had a complete different approach. We ended up kind of hunting a different area and stuff, because the place we went was actually the place that I hunted the 2 years prior to that were, it was on public land. It was on the corner of two, private properties. It was like a little L shaped thing. And we found a corner of public land, and we actually were on the public land, but it was like a little fly zone of dove, that like to fly along these tree lines. And so it was like a perfect little spot. Well, then this last year I went with just my wife, and somebody was there, and then we had a bunch of people end up showing up like super late in the morning, and then it was just a mess. So yeah. Then the second day we ended up going with a friend of mine that was out there, and they go every year, and they would go to a different, completely different spot. It was a couple miles away, and it was just totally different. We were actually hunting in orchards, in citrus orchards. And it was totally different hunting too, because like where we were flying out before was, or where we were hunting out before was a fly zone. So we just kind of sat under a tree and you just waited, and they would all fly kind of the same direction. It was just like, they'd fly over. So we'd get white wing or mourning dove or Eurasian dove. And they normally would all have like their own height, so you could almost tell which ones were coming because of where they were flying at, you know? And, so it was real, it was almost like duck hunting. You know? You kind of just sat and waited and they would just come popping out. And then, but everybody could kind of sit in the same little zone. This other place where we went, it was all orchards, and we just made a line across these orchard roads, and you would just sit there and wait, and they would go. There was some old growth orchards and some new growth, and we were sitting in the new growth waiting for them to come over the top of the old growth orchards, and they would just come shooting like bullets over the top. So you had like a few seconds to shoot at these things, or they were in the, or they were far behind you in the orchards, you know? And so it was a trip. It's a total different style. And like, they didn't use decoys. Where we were at, we would use decoys and they'd come down to the decoys. So I personally really like dove hunting. I wish we had more waterfowl around here, because I love that. That's, I feel like it's pretty similar. As far as like the way that you can hunt them and bring them in. But yeah, I mean, we'll have to get out and go dove hunting sometime, because I have a couple of places that I'm allowed to go, that are private property, and it is hard to get the spots, but as long as you're pretty, respectful and stuff, a lot of people aren't super, I guess you'd say like protective over. Like, cause I normally go for Eurasian dove, and which is an invasive species, and you can hunt them year round.
You can hunt them year round.
Yeah,
so as many as you want.
And so when you present that to the landowner, they're like, "Yeah, we see these things like by the hundreds." Yeah, they're like, "There's no, you know, they don't feel like you're, you know, when you shoot quail, when you're trying to get permission to hunt quail on somebody's property, there's normally like one or two coveys on their whole property, and so you're going and blasting."
Well, those people love quail.
Yeah, they're cool. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So a lot of the time.
they don't want you to hunt them or whatever.
Exactly. They're cool looking or whatever. And it's like, I totally understand that. So for me, whenever it comes to private land hunting access, I always try to look at like what, you know, what would they not mind if it was gone, or what could they benefit from me taking from their property? And a lot of the times the dove is one of those things, because they're a scavenger. So whether they're annoying, like they're just a nuisance, or they're actually, you know, taking grain or destroying crops kind of thing. So it's an easy way to get in. And I, like I said, I love doing it. But yeah. And then, so you do, when you go quail hunting, do you normally go on private land or public?
In the past, I've mostly done private land. Again, that's just a blessing that I have in my life from having so many contacts and connections and stuff. But recently I've been trying to get into public land stuff since I've been able to hunt on my own. You know, becoming 16 and getting a car is a great freedom.
Yeah.
And then becoming 18, be able to buy your own shotgun is an even bigger freedom. So since I've been able to do that, I've been trying to expand public land hunting, but not very well, if I might add.
It definitely adds another challenge, doesn't it? Because you're really dealing with other hunters.
Well, more so than that, it's putting in the time and really scouting, and I didn't as much as I should have.
Yeah.
And so, I have a couple like public land spots that I've found since I've been able to do that. So like high school and stuff, I found a couple of small like local spots, and they're not a lot of ground to hunt, but there's enough birds to keep you busy for an afternoon.
Yeah,
I mean, you couldn't go and hunt them like every weekend, because you just run out of birds and you scare them and make them smart. But if you're only going once or twice a season to those public spots, then it's not a problem. But I tried to go up to Los Padres this year, and I found more deer sign than I did quail sign. So that tells you how good of a quail hunter I am with public land.
That sounds like my last hunting trip, though. We went and tried a new spot. Like, it's not a new spot for me, but it was a new spot for hunting quail. And I felt really bad, because the guy that I took up, he's from Wisconsin, and he's got a dog, and he's, you know, wanting to take his dog out. So he hit me up, and I've taken him out before. And so I told him this one time around, I was like, you know, we could try some other spots, because, you know, last time we went up, like I told you before, I'm not a guide. I'm not, you know, I don't know all the honey holes and stuff. I was like, I just know, I know the area. And, you know, I used to hunt bird a lot when I was like almost right out of high school. Like I was like, what was it? It was probably like around like 20 to 22 ish. And now I'm a little over 29. So I'm going to be 30 here pretty quick. So it was, you know, it was almost 8-10 years ago that I was hunting quail, like, pretty regularly. And then I just kind of fell off of it, just because we had a lot of dry seasons. And back then it was a lot different. I mean, I would go up and we would limit out in 2 to 3 hours, versus I haven't limited out since that time. You know, so like, it's like all the other times that I go, it's like I'm lucky. I mean, I'll be stoked when I hit, you know, on a regular basis, I'll be able to get like 5 or 10 birds. Not like it's not very easy. And I even have some, you know, some private land, but I feel like private land's not as big of a thing with quail, because the natural habitat is really, you know, unless you have people that just have untouched like wilderness land, then that might be better. But like most of the public land, or the private land that I have, is more like farmland, and quail don't really care for that. They'd rather
they like the sagebrush.
They might run around the edges for the water when the water gets tight, you know, like when there's not a lot of water around. But I haven't really had much success. And the other problem that I've had, like the first time that I went with this same guy, we went to a private property spot on opener day this season. And there was too many predators, because it was all like hay fields and stuff. So the predators were just so thick that, you know, like, I mean, there was hawks flying everywhere. So nothing wanted to fly. We saw a coyote. We saw tons of signs of tracks from bobcats. And, and it was like, shoot, there's so many predators around that nothing wants to move.
Yeah.
It's not even so much what they're putting, you know, what dent they're putting in the population of quail. It was more just nothing wanted to move. They're hiding, you know, they're in hiding from it. And so I felt bad because I think we only got one quail at that spot, and then we ended up going to a different place and ended up getting, I think, like two more or something like that. But it was still a really rough day. And then, like I said,
three times better than I've done this year.
Well, then we went to the second time I just took them out, we went, and, you know, we went to a canyon that I went to a lot when I was younger, and, but we used to go camping and four buying back in it. But I had a few people this year tell me that there's been quail back in there, but it's a huge canyon and there's a bunch of fingerling canyons off of it. And I told the guy beforehand, I go, it's a big place. It's not like we're going to pull up to a field. There's going to be a ton of quail out there. I was like, they're saying there's quail back in there, but where in those canyons? I don't know where, you know? So we pulled off and we went in there, and then we hit a spot where it was really muddy. So we just parked right before there, and we're like, all right, we'll just shoot off on this little side canyon. And we walked up it, and man, dude, I was like, man, I'm going to be coming back in here for deer season. There was just deer tracks everywhere, man. But we didn't even see a single quail. We didn't hear or see a single quail the whole time. And we probably covered a couple miles just walking around in these fields and stuff. But I was like, man, at least I found some good new deer spots to come looking around, you know? But
yeah, that's how my quail season up in Las Padres went.
You were deer scouting?
More or less. I found a bunch of deer tracks. I found one nice buck track and a bunch of deer scat and stuff.
Yeah.
And I didn't see or hear or see any tracks or anything of any quail. So
were you off of the 33 or were like Lockwood area or?
Yeah, I went all the way up to Lockwood, but I went up to 33 and I just stopped at spots that looked. I looked on Google Maps and I looked for spots where I thought there might be water, and I looked for spots where I thought I could get in from the road and hunt up a couple canyons. So I just took my time. I left early in the morning, got up, started driving up 33 by 8 o'clock in the morning, and I just went up and hunted the whole day. And I went all the way over, all the way up, and drove up to Lockwood Valley, and nothing.
Yeah. See, I've had more luck. You know, I don't want to give away spots just because I think you're going to take them from me, but, you know, I don't know who's listening to it or whatever, but I've had more luck as kind of a tip on, you know, like terrain wise, I feel like I've seen more birds and I've had more luck. The more, I guess it'd be north that you go from Lockwood Valley. I feel like Lockwood Valley, I have a thing where I feel like if you see pine trees, there's going to be less quail. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I think you're right, because valley quail, they call them valley quail for a reason. They live in low elevation, generally below 5,000 feet. And then mountain quail, they live in high elevations.
Yeah.
You know, 5,000 up.
So what I was going to say is, so I normally go a lot farther up the 33, like even all the way up towards the 166. And I've been wanting to get up and hunt more on the 166, actually, because there's a lot of really good hunting grounds up there that I've heard about. And I've seen lots of pictures, actually. I don't know if you follow, there's a big reserve up there, a game reserve. I'm going to draw a blank on the name of it. But they have an Instagram page, and it's got some of the coolest trail cam photos.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I saw a picture of it.
Yeah.
I think I know what you're talking about.
That's going to drive me nuts, because they actually have, so it's like a conservation area, like big old ranch that was, Chiminera. I don't know how you pronounce it right, but it's a huge plot of land, and there's certain areas that they allow walk-on hunting, but from what I understand, you have to like put in for a permit. Like they do like a permit, and then there's like only certain days you're allowed to hunt, and then so there's a lot more to it than just like showing up and walking and running, from what I understand. But then they do like raffle hunts where they actually take people farther in the ranch and let you hunt. And then they have, because it's crazy, man, it's like not that far away, but they have elk on that property. They have tule elk, and then they have antelope, like pronghorn antelope.
No kidding.
And then they have, like, their trail cams, man. If you watch them, like, they have, Yeah, if you don't follow them on Instagram, you should check them out, because they have like video footage of elk coming into these watering holes and bobcats, mountain lions, bears. I mean, you watch it and you're like, there's no way that's only like an hour or two away from my house. You know, it's like, man, it feels like you're in a whole other state and just watching their videos. Wow. So it's pretty cool. And, you know, and that's one of the coolest things. Like, that's why, you know, I'm saying like, you should check it out, because I feel like a lot of people, and this has been my whole movement with the whole Cali Outdoorsman thing, is just to try to shed light on what we do have. And like, that site, to me, I still even, like, I believe that California's got some of the, like, best hunting and fishing in the United States. And, you know, that page actually still kind of blows me away sometimes, because it makes me feel like it's, like, not even possible to be, mainly on the big game. Like, when you see, I feel like elk are just so, like, myth, like, I don't know, like, I want to say mythical, but not really, like, you know, like, they're just...
Yeah.
Once you see them, it's you feel something
there's
different.
Some mystique.
Yeah, you know, it's like seeing a unicorn. You're like, whoa, man. You know, it's like I feel like elk are one of those things in the hunting world that really, you know, it just captures people when you see one in real life, and antelope
the
too.
Elk is only in California.
Yep.
There's Roosevelt they've introduced, and there's other kinds of, there's other subspecies of elk, and most of them get a lot bigger than Tule elk, but there's just something about Tule elk, California Tule elk. You could, like, if you see pictures or videos of them, they're bugling on, like, the cliffs right next to the ocean up in Northern California and stuff, and you're like, wow, man, that's just incredible.
Yeah. We actually saw some,
did I lose you?
No, are you there? Can you hear me? Brendan?
Uh-oh.
Oh, there you go. You there? I don't know what's going on there.
Did you hit mute or something?
No. Let's see here.
You
hear me?
I heard you now.
Now you hear me? All right.
Yeah.
I turned you off a speaker and put you back on, so I don't know what it did. But, we actually saw some, what was it, like 3 or 4 years ago, went up to Northern California up by the redwoods that are near the coast. And I didn't even know, like, we weren't looking for them. We went up there on a for a wedding. A family member got married up there and drove through this one valley. And it was funny because we pulled in this little valley and there's like this big old sign that says Elk Refuge with an arrow. And I was like, I like looked over my wife. I was like, we're going to pull in there for a few minutes. I just need to see if there's elk in this elk refuge. And then she's like, all right, whatever. We pull in there and it's just an empty parking lot. And there's like a bathroom there. And it just like looks over this big old massive meadow. And so I pulled up and I just kind of looked around and I was like, no, we would see elk if they were here. Like, elk are not like a deer where you got to look for them real hard, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
they kind of stick out.
Especially if there's a herd of them, right? So I was like, yeah, there's nothing here. So then we just pull out and I'm not even kidding you. The next turn on this road, like on the highway that I was going, so we pull out and we're heading north again. And then at the next bend, we come around and there's like a, I think it was actually like a ranger station. But it was like a ranger station where, like, there's not anybody really, like, it's not like one that you stop at. It's like where, like, forest rangers go and stay or something. So, like, nobody's there, but it's just like a nice, well-kept, like, house cabin looking thing. But it's right off the side of the road and it's got a mowed yard with a little fence around it. And there's like 20 elk just chilling around this thing. And we're like, and like everybody, like the whole highway is like stopped cars because everybody's checking out these elk that are literally like right on the side of the road. And we have pictures of me, like, we got out with my daughter and we're walking over and like taking pictures of these elk, because there were, you could take a picture and have the elk in the, like, you know, it's only like 50 feet behind you. And it was like, whoa, you know, I felt like I was like one of those bad tourists that always gets beat up or something, but, but there was plenty of other people. There was plenty of people between us. Like, I told my wife, I was like, we're not getting that close. Like, those people over there, they're going to get trampled first. So we got some pictures, but we kind of kept our distance, but yeah, like, seeing elk in California is awesome, man. And it's like I said, it's one of those things where it's like almost mythical when you see one You're just like,
yeah,
it's like you were with your, with the Corbina, you know, it's like, you don't really, you know, they're there, but then like, until you really see it, it's like, you don't feel it as much, you know?
Yeah. And if you want to talk about a unicorn for a tag, that's a unicorn for a tag.
Yeah. Unless you got a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. Unless you're much better off than the average hunter in California is.
Like Joe Rogan. Did you see Joe Rogan's? Yeah. He just got one which I don't blame him. I mean, shoot, if you got the money, go for it. Yeah. On Tejon Ranch, he got one. Yeah. And it was almost, I want to say it was like almost like a record-breaking one or something. They got some massive ones on Tejon Ranch, but.
Yeah, they do. But they're, you know. They have guys that watch them all year long, and basically until someone with enough money comes along, picks one out.
Which, you know, it's one of the coolest parts about Tejon Ranch, I feel like, though, is they're, you know, even though they are a hunting ranch, they are very wild still. And I feel like that's what you pay for, I feel like. Because if you pay to go on a hunt on Tejon Ranch, you're not paying to go, you know, you're not just getting a guide on public land. You're getting a guide on a massive, like, it's private land, but it's basically a huge wilderness that nobody else can, you know, they have limited amounts of hunting on. So I feel like they're, you know, even though they are super expensive, I feel like you are getting a pretty good deal for your money when you do that type of hunting versus, you know, some of the other hunting ranch type style things.
Yeah.
You
know? I've never done anything like that. I've never hunted outside of, is that true? Yeah, I've never hunted outside of Ventura County that I can think of.
Really?
So, yeah, I'm local through and through.
Oh, wow. So you've never done any out-of-state hunting at all?
No, I never have. My uncle had been putting in for points in a number of states for a lot of years.
Yeah.
And this year, my uncle's actually one of just a handful of people to draw the Henry Mountains.
Oh, that's right. You were telling me about that.
Rifle tag. Yeah, so that is considered by most people to be the holy grail of mule deer hunting.
Yeah.
It's in Utah. And he said it was a lot harder than everyone who said to draw the tag had told him it would be.
Yeah.
But it took him 27 years to draw the tag. He was one of three match point holders in the country. And his buddy Paul, who I mentioned was our fishing buddy who just passed away, he was another one of the top point holders. They'd been putting it together for 27 years.
Wow.
And they both drew it, and Paul passed away before he could go.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was a bummer. But my uncle got to go, and he harvested a bomber mule deer. He's going to be in the magazine and stuff with it. So.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, so keep an eye out for Muley Magazine. You'll see some Henry Mountains bucks. And nice. One of them is my uncle, so.
Yeah, I follow a page, the Henry Mountain Bison Hunting. Have you followed them?
Yeah, I follow him too. That's insane. He said he saw tons of bison. He said he saw way more bison than he did, like, monster deer.
Really?
The only deer they saw that was, like, the famed Henry Mountains 200-inch-plus deer was the deer that he got. And not to trash other people or people who hunt and stuff, but he said that the Henry Mountains was really hard because there's lots of like rich people who hunt it, and they buy these lottery tags that are like $100,000.
Yeah.
And so then they hire these guides, and these guides have like 50 people working for them. So they kind of crowd everybody out. They crowd out the do-it-yourself guys, like my uncle. And so he said it was really, really hard because all of the big deer were basically just surrounded, and you just couldn't get to them. But he got lucky, and that buck slipped through, and he just happened to get on him because he brought some guys who can hike way farther than any guy who can pay for a hunt can. And he got some crazy, I mean, real crazy, like, people that I think would kill me if I tried to go hunting with them because I would just die of a stroke from walking too far.
Yeah.
So, but he got super lucky.
When did he go back? When was that?
That was back in October. So he started, he drew the tag, I think in May. I think he was going to draw the tags.
Yeah.
And he found out that he drew it finally. And so then he started scouting in June, and he made like 5 or 6 trips, and he built for like a week.
Yeah.
He retired, so he only worked part-time. And he told his part-time job, he's like, listen, I'm taking this time. If you're going to fire me, I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm going. I'm telling you right now. And so he didn't have to quit because his management was fairly understanding. He's like, this is my chance.
Yeah. And it's a once-in-a-lifetime hunt.
It's more than a once in a lifetime hunt. It's a once in,
if you're lucky,
many generations.
Life. Yeah. If you're lucky, you get once in a lifetime.
Yeah. So he went and did it, and he put in tons of work. He put like 20,000 miles on his truck between all the trips.
Wow.
And he hit a deer on the way home from when he got his buck. He hit a deer on the highway.
Oh man.
Like, messed up the front of his truck, and a bunch of crazy stuff happened. Like, I'm sure he's going to write about a lot of it in the story, so
yeah.
Check out Muley Crazy Magazine when it comes out this year for the rest of the story. But yeah, it was just one of those things that was super crazy.
That's awesome.
But
so
he had all these points, and so I never put in for out of state because he couldn't use his points. He's not going to throw away his max point holders.
Yeah.
He's also a max point holder in Arizona, so you never know if he draws the Arizona strip or whatever. He might go kill another giant buck.
Yeah.
But, so I never got to go because he's my hunting partner, so.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to get together. If you want to go hunt out in Wyoming, I'd be down to go because I want to try to do some more deer hunting out there. So I'm going to try to start putting in for points and stuff. Cause that's one of the hardest parts is, you know, I feel like out of state hunting. Well, I feel like out of state hunting is getting pretty popular now. And, for out of state people, I mean, we have a lot of guys coming from California, but people go from all over the world to go, or not all over the world, but all over the United States to go hunting in a lot of these same places, you know, like people, you know, Colorado is one of the ones that's always known for elk. Wyoming, they're real big for mule deer and yep. Elk too. And then, you know, one of the things that stinks is I was talking to a lot of the guys back there this year, and they have a lot of whitetail deer that people don't really notice, and they actually have pretty decent sized whitetails, but everybody goes out there for mule deer because of those bigger deer. And I was like, shoot, well, you guys should make a separate tag then, because I'd be down to come and get a big whitetail deer.
Yeah,
it would be cool.
People want to go down, and, you know, they don't want to waste a tag that you can potentially shoot a giant
mule deer
on a whitetail.
Exactly. And that's what ends up happening is they said that, like, basically, like, the people that do hunt whitetails around there are typically, like, the farmers. Because they're all on their property, and they're like, man, that's a massive whitetail. So then they'll just go pick up a, you know, so most of the time the whitetails are normally harvested by locals that are,
that
just see a big deer on their property. Because a lot of them, the whitetails are, they're kind of like Eurasian dove. They hang around the hay fields and stuff. So a lot of the times they're all harvested.
Out of state hunting, just hunting does. Like, you went and got your doe and
all of
stuff.
It's fun, man.
I would just love to go out and experience the out-of-state hunting culture and lifestyle. You know?
And I think that the does, I'm going to look into this year too, Utah, because I've heard that Utah isn't too bad for pulling doe tags. And I personally, like, I love the antelope meat. That's why I like going for them. But they're pretty plentiful where they live.
Right.
Like, they don't, it's not like, they're not like deer around here where you're going to see 2 or 3 of them. Like, when you see antelope, you're typically looking at a group of like 10 to 20. And normally, you know, like if you have access to go hunt on, because hay fields, they love hay fields. And, but they live everywhere that there's sagebrush too. So, like, you know, which is the majority of Utah and Wyoming and, you know, a lot of those other states around there, they're everywhere. So, like, they're almost like rabbit hunting, you know, but they're in big groups. So it's typically not if you're going to get one, it's when and how big you're going to get, you know?
Right.
And that to me, it's kind of like the whole, what we were talking about earlier, like the tug is the drug type thing, but with hunting, because it's like going out of state hunting, like, you know, like you're, your uncle, I mean, look how much experience he had. And he was saying that that hunt was actually like pretty challenging for him. And it's like, imagine if me or you drew that tag and then we don't, and then we didn't fit, you know, we didn't have, we weren't prepared for the hunt. You know what I mean?
I'm not as choosy as my uncle is. He really wanted, he said he was going to go and shoot a 200 inch deer unless it was the last day. At last light on the last day, he would have shot a smaller deer. He said he saw plenty of, you know, 26 to 28 inch four pointers, which is a nice deer.
Yeah.
But it's not a Henry Mountains deer.
Yeah. That's, well, if you put in for that long.
And anywhere else, nice, but in the Henry Mountains, he said there were a dime a dozen. He saw probably 40 or 50 deer that would fall in that range.
Yeah. And that's the other thing that I need to look into more is, like, as far as, you know, I gotta do a little bit more of my studying as far as what we should be putting in for, and you know what I mean? Because, like, if we, for example, like I said, like, what happened if me or you put in for a Henry Mountain deer and then we got it the first year, and then it's like, we would be spoiled.
That won't happen,
but. Well, I know, but I'm saying, like, but there is certain, like, in Wyoming, for example, you can put in and just be part of the random draw. So it doesn't matter about your points. Like, we could put in for,
same in
for something.
I can put in for certain zone stuff.
Yeah, you can put in for antelope or elk too, tule elk, and we could randomly get it. But we could be totally unprepared for it and totally blow it. I mean, you could draw one of those tags where there are all these big old bomber mule deer, and then you could just pull up there and be like overly excited and be like, there's a legal buck and shoot it. And it's like the smallest buck you're going to see the whole trip, you know, because we don't have that experience. And, you know, so that's one of the things that I got to look into too, because like the area where I do have private land access to hunt deer, they were saying it's really hard to draw tags, for deer. They said it's, I mean, even for local residents, they said it takes like almost 10 years of points accumulation to get, to get a for a resident. And so they're like, so it's really hard for non-residents. So I need to look into the different zoning and stuff and see, because like you said, I mean, I'd be fine with going back there and just shooting a doe. You know, a doe mule deer is still huge, man. Those things are bigger than ours. You know, the antelope are about the antelope does are about the same size as our deer are here. So like the antelope doe, like going out there for antelope does, it's like I said, it's pretty much like the same as getting a deer around here. But I'm still trying to get an antelope buck. I've gone 2 years in a row now. And the first year I got, I put in every year for two does and one buck antelope. And the first year I got drawn for both my doe antelope tags and I didn't get my buck antelope. And then this last year I only got one of my doe antelope tags and I was like, man. So, and then the other thing that I was bummed about is I didn't realize. So like for residents, and I had kind of gotten some guidance from the people that live out there that I go hunting on their property. And I had been told that, you know, if you put in for the tag, like you pay for the tag, if you don't get drawn, because the way that they do it is you pay for the tag. If you're going to put in for it, you pay for it. And then if you don't get it, they reimburse you. So they keep a little, like a small fee, but they reimburse you for most of it. And for locals, like for, not for residents, then you also get a point. So like if you put in for a buck or a buck, antelope, you get 1 point. So if you didn't draw, they give you a point and they give you your money back. And so that was what they had told me. They're like, yeah, so, you know, just keep putting in for it. And if you get it, you get it. If you don't, then, like, you know, you got a point for it. Well, this year when I got back, I had got an email saying something about the point system. So I was like, oh, that's weird. Well, I should have 2 points because I put in for bucks 2 years in a row now and I haven't got them. And I went and looked at it. And then, like, down in the fine print, if you are a non-resident of Wyoming, it does not work that way. You still have to buy a point. So the last 2 years, I've been thinking I've accumulated points, but I haven't gotten points. So now I'm like, shoot, now I got to start putting in for points.
I start over.
And then, I was like, man, like, so there's a lot. And what stinks is every state is different. So that's one of the hardest parts about out-of-state hunting is just learning, you know, kind of learning the loops. I'm looking into Utah and, I do want to try some Arizona hunting. I know that they have some pretty good tags and stuff that are not too extreme. And then
yeah, I mean,
Oregon
where
too.
You want to go in Utah and stuff? I've heard you can get well, you can get over the counter stuff, especially if you're into archery. You can get over the counter stuff all day long. But even as a non-resident, but you can get like tags that take 2 or 3 years to draw and have a chance at a deer.
I was kind of telling my wife that I think what I want to try to do is kind of come up with a plan. I got to figure out like what areas I want to go to, because like I think Wyoming, most of the places I'm gonna have to get like 4 points for a deer, a buck deer. So like if I start accumulating points now, but then like next year I'll go hunt whatever, like maybe over the counter Arizona tag or. You know, and try to make make a plan where I have like a hunting trip planned each year according to how many points I need, kind of thing. I was like, I need to look into it. I know that they actually have apps for doing that that help you organize
Onyx Hunt. I've heard of, there's Onyx Hunt and Go Hunt Insider. There's lots of.
So I still, like I said, I'm pretty new to the whole big game thing, so I'm still trying to learn the systems, and I was pretty bummed when I found out about the whole point system in Wyoming. So let's get back to like your thing on hunting. So you've hunted deer. When did you first go hunting for deer?
I was 9 and I tagged along. I mean, I've been like,
you've been around it.
Yeah, I've been around it, or like I've been driving around and looking for deer scouting, or my aunt has like an injury with her knees or she can't hike, and so we would drive the access roads and service roads on this private land, and then if we saw a deer where we could get out and walk close enough to get a shot on, you know, relatively stable ground, I could go with them. But we never got a deer when I was doing that. It was just driving around and looking and stuff. But the first time I was around deer hunting when we're actually like hiking in and stuff, I was probably 9 or 10, and it was with my cousin, and he actually got a deer that time when we went. So that was my first exposure to like legit deer hunting.
Then when did you actually start going hunting for yourself?
For deer?
Yeah.
The minute I turned 12, I took my hunter safety course, and I was like, man, I am like itching to go. So opening day of A Zone South. In 2012, I was big stuff. I actually got so nervous that when we got out of the truck and, you know, put on our day packs and load our rifles and stuff, I threw up because I was so nervous.
Oh yeah, I totally.
And I told my cousin, I was like, "Man, I'm gonna throw up," and he was like, "Nah, you'll be fine." I was "No, I'm gonna throw up," and he's like, "No, you'll be fine." And he started walking away, and I threw up. And he was like, "You idiot." I'm like, "You can't help it, man." I've been waiting for that moment for like 7 years.
Yeah.
Like, to finally be able to go deer hunting with a rifle in my hand and a tag in my pocket.
Yeah.
And, so I started right away, 12 years old.
And did you get one that year?
I did. It took a lot of hard work, and that was still when deer hunting was comparatively easy to now. We didn't have such big of a lion problem, so the deer herd was a lot better where I go deer hunting. Put it in perspective, before my first deer hunting season, my uncle had spotted 20-something legal deer, so, you know, 4 feet or better, before the season. And then 4 years later, on the ranch where I was going to go, the same ranch I had gone opening day in 2012, he hadn't seen a single legal deer before the season.
Wow.
So, yeah, they introduced some lions from another area. They relocated them because there was a fire.
Yeah.
And they found out that there was a really good deer herd in the area that we were, and so they released them there. They got permission from the state or whatever to release them there. And so that took care of the good deer herds, but anyways, to not cry about it, because I've still been very fortunate.
Yeah.
Hunted a lot, and didn't get anything, and so my buddy who lives in Santa Paula and ranch, it was this larger ranch. I knew it was my first year, but I hadn't seen any legal bucks or anything. So he invited me to go hunt on his place with my uncle. And got super fortunate, and actually, we're going to go up this big mountain down the other side. And there's supposed to be some bucks in there. Well, we're driving through the avocado orchard, and there's bucks in the avocado orchard that we're driving through. So he slammed on the brakes. I said, get over here and kill this buck. So I ran over there, and he was like 30 yards away. And there was two bucks, and they were crossed. And the big one was in back. He was a nice forky. There's a little fork in front. I was going, break the big one's neck. Break his neck. And I wanted to wait, so I waited, and the little buck moved, and then I shot the other one. Nice. And he ran about 10 yards and dropped, and that was that. So that was just like stupid, dumb luck.
Well,
I hunted hard all season and
I haven't
seen anything and drove through an orchard and shot one from 30 yards away. So.
I'm a pretty firm believer in it's not stupid, dumb luck. It's just being out there. If you hear both of my stories with my deer, man, they're basically that same way. They're not like, I've gone out and I've gone, long periods. I still haven't done, I want to do the packing in type thing. I still want to experience that. I haven't personally done that for deer. I've done it just for I've gone backpacking and stuff with my family, but I've never actually packed in for deer hunting.
Right.
So I'd love to do that experience, but just the day hunts, I put in a lot of days going out and scouting and searching and searching and searching. And then both my deer is literally like when I gave up and was headed home, they presented themselves to me and I was like, what the heck? It's like, it was like, I was so over it. Didn't think it was going to happen. Finally, basically was thrown in the towel. And then they just popped out of nowhere, it seemed like. And I was like, oh my gosh, then. Yeah. Like you said, it's like that. I feel like I get super nervous and sick when I see illegal deer. It's not even like, it's not so much the hunting. Like, I get pretty amped about going hunting. But when I see illegal deer is when I really start getting like,
fever.
Yeah. And especially I feel like around here, it's because we have such steep terrain that when you do see one, they're typically within range. And you, it's one of those things like you're going to have to react fast or they're going to disappear. They're like ghosts,
right.
So it's like that. I think that's what really gets me going is it's like, it's just so many emotions hit you so fast. You're like surprised, shocked. You got to do something fast. So you got to react. And then so then you start getting nervous. You there?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay. But yeah, there's just so many, you're just overwhelmed with different stuff. And it truly is an amazing thing when you actually get your first buck. So, so since then, so you got your first one, that was your first year when you were 12, right?
Yep.
And then how many have you harvested since then?
I was just trying to figure that out. I was just thinking about it. I think I've gone two seasons without a deer since I started. So I think I've got six deer in 8 years, eight seasons.
That's pretty good.
I only get one deer a year. I never buy the second tag.
And do you primarily hunt A zone?
Yeah, I've only hunted A zone.
Okay. Man, that's so hard hunting.
Season happens first, and I've gotten lucky enough that I just hunt A zone.
Yeah.
Plus, D13 is pretty much all public land, and by that time, my uncle is already my uncle's really popular within our hunting group, and so he goes hunting with tons of people. He's just like, other people are like, I'm going hunting. He's like, all right, I'll tag along as a pack mule or whatever, and so he's out all the time.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, since I don't know anybody else who hunts D13, I just feel kind of lost going on my own, especially hunting public land with so many other people.
Yeah. Well, now you found some new hunting spots, right?
Yeah, so maybe this year I'll get the 13 tag.
Because I will.
And I can meet all the other 30 people going up there and hang out with them. So.
I was going to say, there's quite a bit of people that go up to D13.
Yeah. I know. I've seen the pictures of, besides the 33 just being a parking
lot.
Well,
typically the 33, like if you go to Pine Mountain, because there's a trail that runs off of the top of Pine Mountain, that's A-Zone, though. A-Zone,
yeah, that's the other side.
A-Zone is the zoo, man. You go up there on A-Zone, and it's like, because it's the first hunting season around here, everybody's going out. Like, there's,
yeah,
I mean,
everybody and their mother's out there.
Yeah, but then D13, that's why I kind of like D13, is I feel like it, even on opening weekend, like, you still get a lot of people that are on the, you know, that are out there. But I honestly don't know if I've really ever hunted D13 opening weekend. I've driven up the 33 just to see how busy it is. Cause I feel like I just don't want to hunt areas that are really heavily pressured.
I do not.
So I really don't. Yeah. When it comes to public land, that's kind of what if I do go up on opening weekends, it's normally to go see what else is, you know, see what other people are doing and see where where's really packed, and to basically try to avoid those areas and go hunting in areas that are not as pressured. Because they definitely, I mean, they're not getting all the deer. There's still tons of deer pulled out many weeks after, but it's just the initial pressure. And, you know, if you got 100 people going out on the same trail, you're going to probably have, like, you know, 50 shots go off that day. So the deer are going to be scattered and all over the place for at least for a couple weeks or something. So, I mean, that's just kind of my own personal theory on it. But D13, if you have never hunted it, I think it's, to me, it's a lot funner and it's a little easier because it's, colder.
Right. Yeah. You know, that's the thing about A-Zone is,
it's just so stinking hot.
90-degree heat, and it's just, like, awful. I actually one time got into real serious trouble. Ran out of water in a deep canyon, and some friends had to come and save us.
Really?
But, yeah, I was, like, 14 and fat, and I hadn't been walking as much as I should have, so that was it was completely 100% my fault, and I wounded the deer, and he fell down a big canyon. So it was just a combination of mostly things that are my fault, and that was bad. But I learned from that, and I haven't let it happen again, so.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's nice about D13, is typically if you drop a deer, you don't have as much pressure to get it packed out as fast either. Like, right. A-Zone, if you don't find that thing within an hour or two, it's pretty much rotted. You know, because, like, at least around in Ojai and right over our hills here, because a lot of the times in A-Zone, it's over 100 degrees. And during A-Zone season, it's like, man, if you got a deer that's laying dead, you know, for more than an hour or two in over 100 degree weather, because they normally go down you know, like they're going to go down in a clearing, which means they're going to be getting full sunlight and crap. And, you know, and then they get bloated, get rigor mortis going and stuff. So,
yep.
So that's like, I know a lot of guys that's the guys that do hunt D13. That's one of their biggest arguments is
late season.
Yeah, that, and then they also, you're closer to the rut, so a lot of the bigger ones are coming out that have been hiding, you know, because of the heat and stuff or whatever. They're just a little bit more skittish or whatever. So supposedly, they say a lot of the bigger ones come out more closer to the rut. But I think this year, well, I don't know. We'll see how it goes. This next year, I really want to try archery hunting, so I think I'm going to try to get an A32 tag, which is the Ventura County archery.
Yeah, Ventura County archery.
I had a buddy that did the muzzle loading one this year. And
my uncle did too, but he didn't get anything.
Oh, really? Yeah, my buddy, he ended up getting a doe, which that's why I want to get the archery, because archery, both of them are either sex. Yeah. And I don't think that I'd have as much of a problem getting on a doe. And because I'm more of a meat hunter, I'd look for bucks, but then, like, if it came down to the last week or something and I haven't been able to find anything, then I wouldn't mind going and getting a doe. Especially cause our herds, we have so many, like there's so many does to bucks ratio around here.
Other than people who hunt those late season non-rifle,
there's nothing taken. Those,
so.
Yeah. So. But, all right, so do you do anything with your deer? Like, because you said you were trying to figure out how many you've taken. Do you, like, do the European mounts or anything, or? Or take the racks off?
European mounted, well, I normally take the skull cap if it's a smaller buck, but this year was the first year that I did my own European, like, full skull mount. I did it by myself, thanks to YouTube and some...
It's kind of a pain in the butt, isn't it?
It's a bit of a pain in the butt. It was my first one ever, so I made some mistakes, but I did my aunt's a couple weeks after she got a buck.
Yeah.
It turned out much better, and I did a lot faster. So it's something that takes practice, definitely.
Yeah.
But it was cool. It was definitely a rewarding experience. Like, I did, I was the only person who touched the spear, you know?
Yeah.
So that was cool. But, yeah, mostly I either just skull cap them, especially if I shoot just a smaller forkey, and I'm like, yeah, you just need to go in the garage or something. And so it's whatever. But,
so you don't have, like, a trophy spot where you have them all hanging?
Right now I have them, kind of scattered around my house. My first buck's in my room, and my buck from this year I put above my doorway because I think he looks good up there. And I got super blessed. I got one 4-pointer, like a true heavy mass 4-pointer with eye guards, like a really, really nice buck from around here.
Nice.
The problem is I shot him in the head. And so, of course I did.
Yeah.
I shot my second buck in the head. By total accident, running away because I spooked him. And then I shot this deer in the head because I shot him and I only hit one lung and he was running. And he was running away from me and I shot him in the head. So that was a bummer. So I actually cut off his antlers because his skull was completely broken. And kind of like reattached them to a different old head that my uncle had in his barn.
Yeah.
And tried to get him right, but I screwed him up a little bit. But it's whatever. They still look good. So
yeah.
Those are in my living room.
You know that you can get, like, if you ever wanted to get that thing mounted, because it is like an impressive rack. They can still do it with a like, if you get another mature buck, they take the cape off of it. Yep, because that's what I actually did with my cape this year. Because mine was just a forky, but he was a mature buck, and So I'm friends with the taxidermist here in Ohio, Chuck Testa, and I went by and just showed it to him because he lives right at the bottom of the 33 here. So I just swung by his house and stopped by because I'd just been working at his house before hunting season. So I stopped by there to show it to him, and then he was like, "Oh man," he's like, "I really want this cape," and I was like, "You can have it, man. I'm not getting him mounted." He was only a forked horn, you know? So he's like, "Oh yeah, I'll take him." He's like, "You'd be surprised at how many people come in and they didn't know how to cape out their deer right, or they shot him in the head, or, you know, something like that." And it's like,
extra tapes.
Yeah. And he goes, "But I mean, if you got a massive buck, like, you still, like, if you want to get it mounted, you know, if it's your best one, then you want to get it mounted, but, like, the cape's messed up." He goes, "You know, like, cape is a cape kind of thing." Like, he's like, "You know, it's not, people aren't going to notice that. They're looking at the rack and stuff like that." So if you do ever want to get it mounted later, as long as you have the skull plate, they can pretty much put it in something similar, especially if you have pictures of it. If there's any, like, whatchamacallit, like, if there was any significant things on his face or anything, or his ears, they can, like, that's what Chuck's really good about that. Like, if you show him pictures of the stuff, he'll make it look as, like, accurate as possible, and as far as, like, making it look like the spitting image of the deer that you shot, not just, like, you know, making all the deers look exactly the same kind of thing. He's very about making them look as real and as much lifelike, like they were when they were alive, kind of thing.
Yeah, I wish I would have looked it up more when I did it. Now I'm okay with him just being a skull because I like the story and I think it was good where he is. So
yeah.
I still think I've honored it well.
Yeah.
But I definitely wish I would have chased it more when I got him. But I completely broke his skull plate, and so you couldn't actually, like, score him. I mean, I could fit the skull plate together so I could tell he was somewhere around 18 inches wide.
Yeah.
Give or take a half an inch or so.
Dude, so my one, the one from this year, I hit him right behind his, like, or right behind his skull plate, so the actual, like, the back of his skull broke off
when I saw it. Saw your picture.
Yeah, and I didn't because when I showed the pictures and stuff, it was loose, but then, like, I ended up boiling it again, and simmered it again to try to get the remainder pieces of meat off. And when it heated up that second time, it freaking the whole back part, yeah. Which it actually worked out because it clicks in and out. But when it pulled apart, I was able to clean out the brain cavity and stuff really good, and then put it back in there. So like I just got to glue it in place. But yeah, it was like literally right at the back of where you would normally would cut off the skull plate. It was pretty crazy where I got it. But
I know. I'm like, man, if I had just shot like 6 inches lower, I would have broken his neck, and I wouldn't have that problem. But
yeah.
Oh well.
Hey, I mean, you still got him.
I got the butt, and I got him home. So
yeah.
I didn't care. I could, as long as I didn't shoot his horns off and I didn't like lose all the meat, I would. I didn't care. So I'm still super happy. And he's like a really, really nice buck.
Yeah.
So I'm happy with him either way.
That's awesome, man. Hey, so. I wanted to, we've been going for quite a while here, so I figured we could kind of wrap it up, but I wanted to touch bases on, what we talked about last time too. You were talking about the big buck barbecue that you've already talked about your uncle a bunch, but so your uncle's the one, it's the same uncle, right? That puts it on.
Yeah.
That puts it on. So you guys do it. It's like a big, what do you call it? It's a big buck barbecue.
We just call it the Hunter's Barbecue or the Deer Hunter's Barbecue. Okay.
And it's like, Ventura County?
It happens in Ventura County, so we call it the Ventura County Hunter's Barbecue. But,
yeah,
you know, people come from up north. We have people who come down from, like, Redding. We have a couple guys who come in from all over the place. So, you know, just because it's the Ventura County Hunter's Barbecue, cause that's where it happens, and that's where most of the guys are from.
Yeah.
You know, it's, like, an exclusive locals-only thing, you know? Like, it's pretty much just a giant get-together where everybody gets together, and that's how it started out. It started out in my uncle's backyard with like 10 guys, and I was there for the first one. I was like 7 or 8.
That's awesome.
And, you know, I was just walking around, everybody's, you know, BSing and telling lies about hunting stories and draining all the deer and stuff, you know. And so it started out like that, and it's really grown. Last year we had almost 200 people.
That's crazy, man. And I'm really looking forward. I'm really looking forward to going this year because, like I said, I've heard of it before, but like I didn't know because it's you guys. Is it like an invite only type of thing, or do you guys? Because I've never really seen. I've only seen people like send me pictures of the flyer.
Yeah, I mean we're not like exclusive at all. I mean, if you hear about it and you want to come, you are invited.
Okay.
That's the basis of it. It's not like. You have to be on a list. They're not checking your name at the front door or anything.
Yeah.
It's if you're interested and you want to show up, it's just Deer Hunter Barbecue. I don't even think we have a website because it's everybody who runs it. I'm the youngest one by far. Everybody else is in their 50s, 60s.
Oh,
wow. We got in our 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
So we're the main guys. So I shouldn't say that. There's a couple of younger-ish guys who are in there probably 30s or 40s, but I'm really the only one who's in the millennial or generation X or whatever age group who's there regularly to help organize and stuff. There's lots of kids and young adults and stuff who come, but I'm, as far as organizers go, I'm the youngest one.
That's awesome.
Which I should probably make a website.
I was going to say, if you don't do a website, you should at least do like an Instagram or something, and I'm sure you could go around and I mean, shoot, if you had 200 people show up, I'm sure you'd get enough pictures of deer heads to where if you just, like, instead of posting them all right after the thing, just post them, like, 2 a month or once a week or something, you know?
Yeah,
and then totally. Just do a news feed.
Maybe this year I will. My dad's super tech savvy. He can help me make a website. So maybe this year I will.
Yeah.
I'll take some initiative.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
But anyways, it's just a giant barbecue hangout. We just want people to bring their antlers. Normally, people bring their antlers from the season before, so this year will be bucks from the 2019 season. And to encourage people to bring their bucks, whether they're big or small, it's a contest, more or less, that goes along with the barbecue and the hangout.
Yeah.
But there's different categories. So there's, like, narrowest buck, and there's, like, out-of-state buck, and best A-zone, best D13, best archery. There's like 20 or so categories, I think. So it's not just like who has the biggest deer ever and there's one winner and everybody else go home.
Yeah.
And there's like, we pick usually two people. In the past, we give out plaques. Now we give out little old-timer knives that are engraved, let's say, Hunter's Barbecue.
That's
and
awesome.
The gear on them. So that's super cool. I carry mine around in my truck. I have a, you know, in case I need a little pocket knife or something. But, yeah, it's super fun. We roast an entire pig. We roast, like, an entire 200-pound pig.
Oh, nice.
My uncle raises pigs, and so we butcher it and roast it for Hunter's Barbecue. So, and do barbecue chicken and garlic bread and chili. Normally I'm cooking the chili, so if you have any complaints, you can direct that to me.
there you go.
Yeah, but no, it's just a giant barbecue and a hangout and a chance for people to check out each other's bucks and tell stories and just have a good time.
Yeah.
So when there's the flyer, they'll send them out, but it's like $20 entry, just to cover the cost of the food and the raffle. Oh, that's the other thing. We have a raffle, and they raffle off super cool stuff. Usually raffle off, like, this past year we had a Traeger grill and it's some Yeti coolers.
Nice.
And, like, some camo stuff, camo clothes, whatever.
Yeah.
And then most of it is guns. So we raffle off, like, hunting rifles and shotguns and some .22s and stuff for kids. And so, yeah, it's super, it's just, like, it's amazing to me how it just went from 10 guys in the backyard cooking too much food and telling lies about hunting stories. And like this huge thing.
Like an event.
And, yeah, just, I mean, we set up meetings to go over what we can improve on from last year. And, it's days of planning. And, so it's a pretty big event and it's a ton of fun. And I encourage everybody to bring their antlers, whether it's a little tiny buck or it's a huge four pointer or it's an out of state deer or whatever. We don't care. Just bring them.
Yeah.
There's nothing to be ashamed of, whether it's a forky or otherwise. And if you have elk, we don't have any competitions for elk, but if you can bring them, we can hang them up. And if you have taxidermy deer, we love bringing taxidermy, whether it's from last year or not. It's hard to get taxidermy from the season prior.
Yeah.
But just bring them and people check them out. And sometimes we make exceptions if they're recent year.
Yeah.
We might make exceptions. And there's also one category called Blast from the Past, and that's deer before 1980. So if you have, like, your grandpa's old deer, or your dad's old deer, or if you're super old and it's your old deer.
Oh, really? I didn't know you guys do that.
Yeah, so you can, I didn't get to mention that last time because we ran out of time.
Yeah.
I might have to talk
my grandpa's buddy into it. He's got a, my grandpa's buddy, he lives right around the corner from me, but he's got a deer that actually, so he's my grandpa's buddy, so he's got to be probably in his 70s, and it's his dad got this deer right here in Ventura County.
Wow.
Off of Pine Mountain, and it's the biggest deer rack I've ever seen in my life, like,
really?
As far as around here. It looks like I wouldn't believe that it was around here, except for I trust him and I know him, so, like,
yeah.
but he said that his dad got him, because I don't know if you'd heard about that story, like, not to get totally sidetracked, but there was there's a story that goes around that says that basically there was somebody that brought in mule deer up by Pine Mountain. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but they brought deer from, like, out of state, and so there was for a few years there was mule deer, like, big mule deer that lived right here in Ventura County, but, like, up towards Pine Mountain area.
Okay.
And they interbred with the blacktail, and then eventually they've kind of pushed the genes back out again. Now,
right.
It's pretty rare that you see something around here that looks like a mule deer, but, like, if you see this buck, like, if I convince him, I might try to convince him now to go out there, because he's probably totally down to go to the barbecue part of it, but if I can get him to bring that rack, would be cool. And the only hard part is, I wonder if he's got any way to prove.
We don't care.
Even if it's just for the story, but I mean, but I don't want him to bring it out and then everyone be like, no, that's from out of state or something, and then him get upset about it or something, you know. But
yeah,
if he's got a picture of his dad or something with it, or if he's got the the hunting, the tag or something that he got it from or some, cause it's cool. I mean, it's, I think, I can't remember what year it was that he told me he got it, but it's gotta be at least like the '30s or it was old, man. It's like, it's super old and it, but it's a big old bomber for around here. But that'd be cool. I'd like to get him out there because he's one of those guys that I always talk. We both got our first buffalo together on the same hunting trip. So he's like and we've been bird hunting and stuff together too. So I always try to get him out to go hunting with me. I like hunting with old guys. It's fun. But sorry to change the subject on that. But I didn't know that when we talked about it last time. So like I said,
I wanted to bring it up because it's important.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you don't, like...
You alright? You there? Brandon? Sounds like we might have lost you. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, there you are.
Did you miss me?
Yeah, I don't know. I was like, what the heck? Something happened. I got it. Yeah, it started getting all ruffled or like making a bunch of noise.
I was just saying, bring the old Max from before 1980 because we love those too.
Okay.
So, but yeah, just it's a family thing. So it's $20 per person, but no more than $80 per family. So if you guys have like a ton of kids and stuff, then we never charge more than $80 per family because we want it to be affordable and we want people to come and have a good time.
Yeah.
So, and if you're like really having money troubles, then try to reach out and contact one of us and we can figure it out because we want people to be there and we want people to have a good time and bring your antlers and stuff. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's great. And like I said, once we get the flyer, I'll send it to you and we can post it all over Instagram and stuff. We'll try to get the word out.
Yeah, definitely.
We try every year, but sometimes it's hard. So we try to get people's information, get their emails, get their phone numbers at the barbecue. That way we can send them flyers so they don't miss it.
Yeah. Yeah, well definitely if you do decide to do like an Instagram page or something, let me know and we can, I mean, I can help you. I know a few other local people here too that we can help spread it. Like, I don't know if you follow the Hunting California guy. He's just up in like Santa Barbara or Goleta. He's not super far from us, but he's got tons of followers and he's all over California. Like he posts pictures from people hunting from all over California. So like I could reach out to him cause we've chatted and stuff back and forth and we could get him to share it and then I'll share it. And so if you have a page, it'd probably be, it's not very hard to start a business Instagram page or whatever. So you can manage it with yours. But I can talk to you about that later, but then yeah, we can share it. And then if you start a page, then people can actually just directly contact you. Instead of trying to figure out.
Good idea.
So.
Maybe I can set up a website or something.
Yeah.
So I'm just, that's kind of a good way to wrap this up is talking about getting the community together.
Yep.
And we want to get all the hunters together. If you fish too, we're not going to hate you if you show up.
Yeah.
But, it's just a big get together. And if there happens to be guns that we raffle and lots of deer and hunters. And it's a good time.
So where is it located at? It's in the Fillmore?
Diverson Road in Fillmore. It's at the Pirate Petroleum Club.
Okay.
It has been for like the past 6 or 7 years, I think.
Okay.
Once I get a flyer, it'll have the address and the price of admission and the date and all that stuff. It's in the end of March. I know that for a fact.
Okay.
So it's usually either the last Sunday or the last Sunday in March.
Okay.
Once I find the date for sure, we're going to be planning it pretty shortly. That's only a few months away.
Yeah.
So we'll have the meeting with all the organizers and the flyer will get made. And so hopefully we'll have that out by like end of January or February, fingers crossed.
Cool, man. Sounds good. Well, was there anything else that you wanted to add to the podcast, or did you
get everything? I just want to add again from the 100 Barbecue. Don't be ashamed of your antlers. Bring them. There's a raffle, and you can win a shotgun, so that's a cool incentive. But also, we just want to show people that there's better hunting out there than you think. Even if it's, you know, 40s, they're still nice bucks and they're legal. And, I see so many guys, they're like, oh, I didn't bring it because I knew someone had a bigger one. And, like, that's not the point.
Yeah.
Like, an old timer knife, you can go to, you know, Big Five or whatever and go buy one right now. So who cares about the knife? We just want to, it's just cool to walk around and see, like, 15 8-foot tables just covered in deer racks.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah.
We just, people walk around.
Especially ones that are local.
Check them out. So, yeah, especially, most of them are local. Most of them are A-Zone and D-13.
Yeah.
So, we just really want people to bring them. And we want more people. So, tell your friends, tell your family, bring them. It's a good time.
Yeah. It sounds like it, man.
We'll be roasting another 200-pound hog, chicken, and all that good stuff. There's plenty of food, so no reason to worry about that.
Cool, man. Sounds good. So, well, thanks for being on the podcast, and we'll link up again soon. I still want to, we got to get out and go do some quail hunting or try to or something soon.
Definitely.
So, do some more surf fishing. Yeah, like we talked about, I think I talked about it when we recorded this podcast last time, that they've been catching a bunch of big surf perch. They've been a little bit more up north, but I'm sure that they're getting them down here. And I don't know if you've seen, but there's actually a couple people that I've seen post pictures of striped bass.
From Ventura County?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I know they come here, but they're even more rare than a Corbina. Like, Corbina, at least you see them all the time.
Yeah, it's like a salmon.
Yeah, they're, like, super rare.
Salmon in Ventura County, but they're rare.
Yeah. So they've been popping up, though. There was one guy that posted one back in September in the Ventura Harbor. He caught one. And then there was another guy that there's been a few of them that have caught them along the beaches everywhere from, like, Channel Islands Harbor up to Carpinteria area.
So, well, if I get this guy from the surf, I'm going to buy a lottery ticket.
Two in the same year, right? Hitting two ghosts in the same year. We only got a few more days to make it the same year, though.
Yeah, I
reminded
fishing license too. Thanks for reminding me.
I know. I forget about that. Cool, man.
Well,
all right. Well,
super fun.
Yeah. Well. I'll like I said, we'll be in contact soon again, and hopefully, maybe next time, I'll probably have you on again as another guest at some point, maybe after the barbecue or something.
We
talk about this upcoming barbecue. So that'd be cool. All right, man. Well, I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. And I can't wait to talk to you more and fish with you and hunt anymore. And
sounds good, man. All righty, I'll talk to you later.
Sweet. Talk to you later.
Bye. So thank you guys for tuning in with talking with Brennan. And like he said, he's a local here. I'm located in Oakview or Ojai, California, and he's not too far from here. I think it's about 45 minutes or so to get to Moore Park, Moore Park's around like Simi Valley area. So he's somewhat local, and like I said, we've tried to meet up and this was. Actually, I think he was one of the first people that I've met through my journey with the Instagram and the Cali Outdoorsman page. And I've been really trying to network with a lot of other people with hunting and fishing. And, you know, he's one of the ones that I've networked, and we've gone fishing together before meeting on Instagram. We never talked to each other or anything, and then we went out fishing, and like he said, we met up and fished for a little while, and then I ended up having to leave early, and he ended up getting a big old nice Corbina right afterwards, which was something that he wanted to do for a really long time. And I was pretty shocked, because I'm not by any means like a guide or really good at fishing for a Corbina. Like I said, I've caught one or two of them before that. I've caught two since then, but, no big accomplishment. But it's just a matter of meeting up and learning techniques and sharing techniques with each other. And, some people get kind of territorial over certain things like fishing for Corbina, but he's caught one, his whole entire fishing career so far. So it's not like he's going and, we're not exploiting a fishery or nothing like that. So I just really encourage everybody to plug in, whether it be on social media or in, you know, your local tackle shops or your local hunting stores, or, you know, joining a Quail Forever club or, you know, a Ducks Unlimited club. There's so many different things that you can do to get plugged in with other, outdoor hunt and, outdoorsmen and women and hunters and fishermen. You know, and it doesn't have to be just because you live in a city area or something. It doesn't mean that you have, that you're limited to that. I mean, I talked to a guy not too long ago that lives up in Carpinteria, and in Carpinteria, well, actually it's Santa Barbara. They have Santa Barbara trout fishermen, like a club. And, he was telling me about it, and I was like, I didn't know there was trout fishing in Santa Barbara, really. Like, you know, there's some lake fishing if you go up to Lake Kachuma or something like that. And he goes, oh, no. He goes, we go to the Eastern Sierras. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, it's just a club here in Santa Barbara, the Santa Barbara Trout Fishing Club. And we go out, like, we make group trips, you know, so we organize big group trips to go out. So it's, you know, it's, that's just one example of many of people that, you know, you network with people that are local that you can hang out with on a regular basis or whatever. And you guys share your passions and stuff and get out there and you know, make these trips happen and get outdoors. And that's what, you know, that's why I brought Brennan on here, was to kind of share about the barbecue. And you know, he has a total different background than I do as far as hunting and fishing. So it's great to hear from somebody, a younger kid that's been introduced from a lot younger of an age, and is still super passionate, about hunting and fishing. And so I hope that a lot of you guys, take his advice. And if you guys are into deer hunting in the Ventura County area, or Santa Barbara or LA County, you know, come and go follow my Instagram page. And or my Facebook page, and I will have, as soon as he gives me the flyer, I will post it up so that you guys can try to attend that, because it'd be a really cool thing to see a lot of you guys out there. And like you said, I think he said it was the last, or it's towards the end of March. So hopefully you guys enjoyed this podcast, and it's a little bit longer than the last ones that I've done. And they'll probably continue to be longer depending on what subjects we're talking about or who I'm talking with. Because I just upgraded my podcast account to where I can actually record longer. Before I was limited to an hour and a half. Now we can go over that, obviously, as I am right now. So if you guys, you know, give me some feedback, make sure you guys comment, or share my podcasts, and hopefully you guys are enjoying it. And I look forward to having some more of you guys as guests, and hopefully I'll be able to get some good guests to keep you guys entertained. And it's actually the day after Christmas right now when I'm recording this in 2019. So I hope you guys had a good Christmas, and I will be publishing this, 2 days after Christmas. I'll be publishing it for tomorrow morning, so Friday. So hopefully you guys have a good New Year's, and I will be publishing another one right after New Year's. So I look forward to hearing your guys' comments. And if you guys have any questions for Brennan, be sure to comment or message me or something on some sort of platform, either Instagram, Facebook, or on my Podbeat account. And I will try to get forward those questions over to Brennan and get them answered for you. All right, well, let's wrap for the end of this podcast, and I hope you guys enjoyed it. I will talk to you guys later.